It's Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're checking out the Berkey Nordic Ski Events and talking with a five-time Olympian who is on the ground in a very busy and thankfully snowy Hayward, Wisconsin. Just about a year ago to this day, Keegan Randall was standing on the Olympic podium in Pyeongchang, accepting her gold medal with teammate Jessica Diggins. This duo, they were the first two American women to win a medal in cross-country skiing.
It's Sweden and the United States, stride for stride, push for push. Who's it going to be, Nilsson or Diggins? Coming down to the line, and the United States has done it! From Sweden and Norway. Oh, what a performance.
What do you want to ask the five-time Olympian? Are you also interested in cross-country skiing or another Olympic sport, but have questions about how to make a career out of it? Do you have remembrances of skiing the Berkey? Let's talk at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Keegan Randall, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Well, you're in Hayward. You're in the thick of it, and you've been participating in some events so far. Can you tell us what it's like there? What is it like on the ground?
From the moment you step into Hayward, you can feel the energy here. Everybody's almost giddy with excitement, maybe a little anxiousness as well, as, 25K and 50K are no joke. You know, it's quite a distance to cover on skis, but just such a great family event here. People are excited. They're coming together, kind of reunions. It's great to see the snow laid down on Main Street. It's a really unique event.
Have you done the Berkey before, or is this your first time?
This will be my first time racing the Berkey.
Oh, fun.
I came to Hayward 3 years ago when I was taking a season off of the World Cup I was pregnant with my son. So I got to kind of see the events in action, and I was actually quite impressed and excited to race someday. And now 3 years later, when my Olympic career has come to a close, I'm excited to be racing myself.
Well, I'm wondering if you're having flashbacks this week, because a year from yesterday, you and your teammate Jessica Diggins did what no other American women had done before. You had won a medal in cross-country skiing at the Olympics and a gold medal. What are those flashbacks like this week?
Yeah, it's been an incredible week to kind of think back to where I was exactly a year ago. As you know, leading into the day, we still didn't know up until about 36 hours before the race which two of us would be racing, because my team was incredibly strong and there were a lot of good candidates for those spots. Once the team was named, actually the whole team rallied around us. We all did a workout together on the course the day before. I knew it was going to be my last Olympic race. So I came into it just with the best mindset, so excited to lay it down one more time, to be with my teammates. And the day unfolded just about as well as it could have possibly gone. We were up against some of the biggest ever competitors in the sport, and we matched them stride for stride. And Jessie had that amazing final 100 meters to not only just get us a medal, but to turn it into gold. And I think what's been most incredible for me is to see the effect that medal has had on our community and on the young skiers in this year since.
Well, on Sunday, you'll be leading a fast and female champ chat for girls between the ages of 8 and 18. What is the mission there?
Well, we're finding that, unfortunately, girls are dropping out of sports at a much higher rate than boys. And all my fellow athletes and I, females, have really benefited so much from being involved in sport, whether we've all been competitive or even the girls I competed in high school with, who are still healthy and active and doing local races. So we want to empower every girl to stay in sports, because we know it'll be really important for her health, for her confidence. And so we host these events around the country where we bring in some of our top female athletes to be the role models and to interact with the girls on a real personal level. We'll be doing a great event at the new building at 00, the Samuel Johnson Center. We're going to be on skis, getting to learn some skills with some of our nation's top racers. And then we'll be sharing some of our inspirational stories about, you know, how we've gone on to win gold medals, but also how we've overcome some challenges along the way. And, you know, we hope to get the girls inspired and motivated to stay involved in sports.
We're talking with Keegan Randall. She is a five-time Olympian and a gold medalist. She and Team USA teammate Jessica Diggins, they were the first two American women to win a medal in cross-country skiing. What do you want to ask the five-time Olympian? Are you also interested in cross-country skiing and want to try a higher level of competition? Where have you found community in cross-country skiing? We're at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Keegan, you've been to five Olympics starting in 2002 in Salt Lake City, and the stakes must have felt incredibly high each time, because when it comes to the Olympics, you train for years for all of this time, and then if you don't medal, there is perhaps that feeling of emptiness. How did you keep yourself motivated to keep going back, keep going back?
Well, I knew in a sport like cross-country skiing, it was going to take me a number of years to build up the training and experience it was going to require to compete for Olympic medals. And so literally after the 2002 Olympics, I sat down with my coaches and we made this 10-year plan of how I was going to systematically work my way up to being a medal contender. And at the time, it was a pretty ambitious thought because no American woman had ever even been top 10 at the Olympics. There was no path to follow. We had to create it ourselves. And so over the years, I started kind of breaking down these goals 1 year at a time. And every time I would reach a goal, it would build my confidence a little bit. And so my second Olympics in 2006, my goal was top 20. And I ended up surprising myself with a top 10. That gave me a lot of confidence going into 2010. I bettered that by one place to a top 8. We were top 6 in the team sprint, just inching closer. Then going into 2014, that 10 years had finally, you know, paid off, been completed. And I went into those Olympics as a gold medal favorite and had all the confidence in the world that I could win that first medal. The day came, it was some challenging conditions. I executed my strategy, gave it everything I had, and ended up 0.05 of a second short from advancing to the semifinals. So my day ended up a lot earlier than I expected. And that was a real character building moment because I realized I'd given everything I had. I'd prepared well, and it's sport. You just can't control everything. But because I gave my best effort, I still was able to walk away from those Olympics satisfied and hungry. And that motivated me to go for another 4 years, mostly because we'd built this amazing team and I knew the team was capable of winning medals and I wanted to be a part of contributing to that. So I think it's a matter of, you know, taking a big goal, not being afraid to dream big, but taking that and breaking it down into manageable steps. And then as you go along, every little success keeps you motivated and you'd be amazed at what you can do.
And, you know, so many of us won't go to the Olympics, but even a 50K marathon is a big goal. How do you put your head into doing a Berkey, a 50K?
Well, that's a great question. You know, this will be my first 50K ever, and I'm definitely relying on all the skills I've built up over my career to come into Saturday with a plan and gonna take down a few. You know, 50K is definitely a big challenge. I'm a little nervous about, you know, making it all the way to the finish with good energy. And so I think I'm going to, you know, take that and break it down again and just take it kilometer by kilometer and have a plan of, hopefully skiing in a group and using some of the competition around me to stay motivated. You know, it's likely to take between 2.5 and 3 hours.
And we're going to
a long time.
We're going to pause right there with five-time Olympian Keegan Randall talking about the Berkey 50K marathon tomorrow. What do you want to ask the Olympian? We're at 800-642-1234. We'll get back to Wisconsin Weekend in a minute on the Ideas Network. You're with us for Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thousands of skiers and spectators have descended on Hayward and Cable for the American Birkebeiner. Events are underway. The Big Ski Marathon is tomorrow morning at 8:15. Finish line is that snow-covered main street of Hayward. And we're talking with the honorary race starter, five-time Olympian Keegan Randall. You've aligned to the Olympic champion at 800-642-1234. Are you a cross-country skier and want to make a career out of it? What challenges have you faced juggling perhaps an illness and athletic competition? What about balancing family and training for elite competition? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. Keegan Randall stays with us. Let's go to the phones now with Kathy joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Kathy.
Good morning. I would just like to send out a special thank you to the Ski for Light program. They're sponsored by the Sons of Norway, and I'm blind, and they pair a sighted guide with blind or visually impaired skiers and also mobility impaired skiers. I skied the Coeur d'Alope 3 times, and congratulations to your guests as an Olympian and for promoting athletes for females.
Oh, Kathy, thank you so much for calling in. And Keegan, adaptive sports is a big, big thing.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Every year we get to interact with some of the Paralympians as they're preparing for the games on the same trails that we're using. We all get together at the end of the season and get to celebrate the success of both teams. And I've been at several ski sites that offer adaptive programs to introduce people to skiing and give them access to do that. And I just think it's wonderful. You know, I think it's so important that we have access to sports for everyone. And thanks, Kathy, for sharing your story.
Let's go to Martha now in Mount Horeb. Hi, Martha.
Good morning. Thank you. Good luck to Keegan. I'll be there cheering on Main Street tomorrow for you, everyone else in the race, my husband, and my 18-year-old daughter who will be doing her first full Berkey. So really excited about that. And I wanted to ask you about the international competition and the camaraderie and collaboration between the teams. I'm also a member of the Sons of Norway organization, and we know that Norwegians, in that country, they're almost born with skis on their feet. And, you know, Americans, we've come a long way, and I've really enjoyed watching the collaboration and I think some inspiration between the two countries. And I just wondered if you could talk about that international level of connection that you've made.
Well, thanks, Martha. That's a great question. That is one of the, I think, biggest benefits that I have found out of my career is the friends I've made that have been my fierce competitors out on the trail. And yet we found we're all very similar-minded people. We just happen to come from different countries. And we've had this shared experience of pursuing our dreams, you know, training incredibly hard, but then traveling around and racing on the World Cup. And so I have some very dear friends that I've made over my years on the World Cup. Several Norwegians. I developed a really fun camaraderie with Marit Bjørgen, the greatest Olympian, Winter Olympian of all time with 15 Olympic medals, who also became a mom just a few months before I did. So we were able to share the motherhood and blending elite racing. And it's just wonderful. I think that collaboration has really developed over the years. And I think it's one of the most powerful things our sport is doing.
You've been described as Team USA's only mom, or have been labeled the mom who skis and who is in the Olympics. How do you approach that focus of family, but also being that Olympic athlete and that label?
Well, I was always excited for parenthood. Of course, being in a career like cross-country skiing, it took me a long time to reach my potential. And so as a woman, I kind of was 31 years old and at this decision point where, you know, did I want to continue racing? And I knew I wanted to start a family. And instead of seeing it as an either or choice, I just decided to combine them. And from the moment I became a mom, I knew my life was going to be enhanced incredibly. And especially as an athlete, being a mom has given me superpowers. It's given me a perspective where I know I go out and I make the most of my time on the snow because I want to set a good example for my son. And as long as I give my best effort, I get to come home to a little boy that's happy to see me. And so I'm glad that I've been able to combine my career and motherhood, bring my son along with me. Of course, I've been able to do it from the incredible support of my husband and our family, no doubt about that, and the support of our team. But it's been wonderful to combine the two.
You've long worn pink streaks in your hair to show people that cross-country skiers aren't boring, but the color pink took on a whole new meaning when you learned that you had breast cancer last May. How has that diagnosis changed your life and your career?
Well, it was quite the 180-degree turn from where I was at that point, having just won the gold medal 3 months earlier, really feeling in peak physical fitness to discover it. There were a lot of emotions, you know, disbelief at first, frustration for, you know, having done all the right things and yet still was facing this challenge. But I quickly realized that all of the experience I've gained through my athletic career was going to really suit me well through this next challenge. And I've brought just energy and determination and staying active to this as I've progressed through treatment. You know, tried to keep a positive attitude, focused on the positive outcome and what I could control. And it's been amazing. It's been tough at times, for sure. The treatment definitely made me feel rough, but I've been able to make it through day by day. And now I'm through the heaviest part of it and just so grateful for every moment I have. You know, my son was the best motivation there was to kind of get up and get out there every day. And now I'm just loving every opportunity I have and excited to be feeling better.
You've been very public and transparent about cancer and your journey through that treatment. And you posted photos of yourself on social media where you're in a hospital bed and about to get a lumpectomy. We see the contrast between those vulnerable moments and the ones we're more used to seeing in you as the Olympic athlete. What was that like to let people in, including your fans, into that particular piece of your life?
Well, as an athlete, you know, I was, you know, used to being kind of a public figure, and well, I love being the role model for all the perfect days of, you know, pursue your dreams, work hard, and this is how it can go. I think it's also important to show the real human side of what I do as an athlete. And so I knew that all the people that had supported me through my athletic career would want to know what I was going through and what was going on. What I didn't anticipate was the incredible outpouring of support that really, for the first time, you know, I was the one that needed help, that needed inspiration, and people were coming to me and telling me I was strong and giving me the confidence that I would get through this. And so by sharing my journey, you know, it's given me a lot of strength, but it's also given me a lot of purpose to fighting through this thing. And I wanted to put the message out there that staying active, staying positive, were the things that were so crucial for me to get through any challenge. And I hope to give people hope and strength that no matter what they're going through, if they kind of focus on staying positive and staying active, you know, then I hope it helps them through their challenge as well.
Keegan, what makes cross-country skiing the absolutely perfect sport?
I grew up doing a lot of activities. I did alpine skiing, speed skiing. I was a runner. I played soccer. And around the age of 16, I realized that cross-country skiing was the combination of all those things I loved about those sports. I got to use my entire body. I got to be strong. I got to have endurance. I got to glide along the snow on my own power and access some just incredibly beautiful places in the world. The people involved in cross-country skiing are really genuinely awesome, great people. And I just am so glad that I've found this sport that is going to be with me my entire life. You know, I've done it competitively, but ultimately I love being outside with my family, and I can do it every single day. And I think it's unique that it's a sport that's so accessible.
All right, so you're doing the Berkey. Can you give a sneak peek at what else is ahead for you here as you look forward?
Well, I feel there's a really cool opportunity to again take kind of what I've learned through five Olympics, through becoming a mom as an athlete, and now having battled cancer, and sharing that story to help inspire and give hope and strength to others. So we've been working on a documentary project. I've been doing some inspirational speaking, which I'm excited to do more of. Also working hard on our Fast and Female program to continue doing more events around the country to keep girls involved in sports. And I was recently elected to the IOC. So I'll be doing work on behalf of the Olympic movement traveling around. So there won't be a dull moment. I can assure you that.
Well, Keegan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be in Wisconsin. Thanks.
Keegan Randall is a 5-time Olympian and Pyeongchang gold medalist. She is in Hayward for North America's largest cross-country ski race, the American Birkebeiner. On Sunday, Keegan will lead the Fast and Female Chat with elite athletes, mentoring young female skiers from 9:30 to noon. That's at the Samuel C. Johnson Family Outdoor Center near Sealy, Wisconsin. More information is at fastandfemale.com. News is coming up next, and then we get the backstory on how the Wisconsin became the Badger State and what lead mining had to do with it. What questions do you have about the state's lead mining history? Join in at 800-642-1234. Stay with us for more Wisconsin Weekend right here on The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. You're with us for a Wisconsin Weekend on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time to dig into, if you will, how Wisconsin became so attached to Badgers. Wisconsin Life producer Maureen McCollum kicks us off as we consider how Wisconsin became the Badger State and what mining has to do with it.
We recently received a listener question in the Wisconsin mailbag. Michael from Dane County asked, why is the Badger Wisconsin's state animal? WPR's John K. Wilson went digging to find out more.
Wisconsin is the Badger State. It's on the flag, it's the mascot of the state's biggest university, and back in 1957, lawmakers put the badger into state law as Wisconsin's official animal. But why? Badgers live in plenty of states, and they're pretty rare here. It's not like you see them running around willy-nilly like squirrels. To get some answers, I figured why not start by going straight to the source. Bucky, pretty common name for badgers, I guess, is the resident education badger at Henry Vilas Zoo in Madison. He goes on field trips and teaches kids about nature, so maybe he'd have something to tell me. On a recent morning, I talked with him in his enclosure while he was eating a hard-boiled egg. Hi, Bucky. John K. Wilson with WPR. Can I ask you a few questions? Do you know why the badger is Wisconsin's state animal? Any idea why you're on the state flag? I've seen this type before. Cute, but not a talker. Clearly, I needed someone with some more specialized knowledge.
My name is Jim Leary, and I'm a retired faculty at UW-Madison in Folklore and Scandinavian Studies.
Leary studies the history and culture of Midwestern people. He said the whole Wisconsin badger thing comes down to
lead mining in the late 1820s and into the 1830s and beyond in the southwest part of the state.
Yeah, lead mining.
In lead mining, there were little holes that people started to dig in and sometimes abandon, and they were sometimes called badger holes. But the prevailing story is that the early settlers actually lived in these holes and that's where the name came from.
Turns out, though, that probably never happened. Leary says historians can't find any reliable evidence that miners actually lived in their badger holes. But either way, the name stuck. So, to boil it down, the badger is Wisconsin's state animal because 200 years ago, people here went digging for lead. And actual badgers also dig holes?
He is a great digger. He's got those really long front claws that are fantastic at digging burrows really quickly.
Back at the zoo, curator Jess Thompson had plenty of other good facts about real badgers like Bucky and his cousins in the wild.
There are a couple different types of badgers. There are badgers that live in Europe, European badgers. There's obviously the honey badger that many people know about in Africa. And there are some badgers that live in Asia and more most of those species are much more social, but our North American badgers are really solitary.
Thompson says badgers are ferocious hunters.
They also have jaws that are really hard to dislocate because of the way that they're attached in their skull. So because of that, they're able to attach really firmly onto their prey.
But aside from hunting prowess and a shared history of digging, is there something about badgers that makes them a good symbol for Wisconsin?
Definitely. Yeah, these guys are so resourceful, and they're known for being tough and being able to make it through a lot of different circumstances. So a lot of great qualities.
John K. Wilson is a digital editor at WPR and is the co-host of the WPR Politics podcast. And this story came to us from a listener question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Wisconsin history includes different kinds of mining, and in the southwestern part of the state, lead and zinc were big business. How is mining a part of your community's history? What about your family history? Share your story at 800-642-1234. Tracy Roberts is a senior lecturer emeritus of the UW-Platteville History Department. She's affiliated with the Mining and Rollo Jamison Museums in Platteville and has been studying the pre-Civil War lead mining district in Wisconsin and Illinois for more than 20 years. Tracy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate. Nice to be here.
So lead mining was big business for Wisconsin during a period of our history. How did it develop in this way and become such a big industry?
Well, you know, we can't see Wisconsin as a state quite yet, you know. Let's say it's 1810. Wisconsin isn't a state. We're dealing with the Michigan Territory. We're seeing things as regional, so we're not going to just talk about Wisconsin, but we're also going to see that what becomes Iowa and Illinois are instrumental in creating the lead mine district. So the French knew about these lead mines early on. They show up in their early maps from the 1600s, and Native American people were using lead. They were using it more to pound it into little trinkets to add to their clothing. They used it for paint on their faces, and they were also using lead to make these really sweet little animals. Sometimes they're shaped like beavers or other animals, and there's been some studies done on those. So really it started with Native Americans and early French recognizing the importance of the lead mine district that we have here.
How did Native Americans mine it? How did they access the lead?
Well, it was very crudely done, so they're using, you know, pre-industrial tools to dig into the earth. The reason why our district is so important, and I say our district because I live in Platteville, so I'm kind of in right in the middle of
it. You're in the thick of it.
Yeah, I am. And so the Native Americans really could find lead sitting on the surface of the earth. That's how easy it was to procure lead in the very early days. Or you could go into a cave or a cliff and find a crack, and there may be lead just hanging off the ceiling or falling on the floor. And you could literally just pick it up. And then you'd have to smelt it. And the smelting process is heating it at a very high temperature, over 900 degrees, to drive off the sulfur and other impurities to make a pure lead that could be used then for making bullets, could be used in later applications for paint for people's houses, which became really popular out east by 1800, 1810. So these were the main uses in the early days with Native Americans.
And when do we see this lead mining boom? When does that happen?
Well, really, it starts with Julian Dubuque, who the city of Dubuque, Iowa, is where he was granted a large quantity of land, not only by the Spanish, who were in charge of that territory in the 1700s, but also by the Meskaki or Fox Indians, who agreed that Julien Dubuc, a French-Canadian man, and his wife could, and his all of his workers, that they would be allowed to mine and also do fur trading and farming on this large swath of land that is now Dubuque, Iowa. So it starts with him being a major influence in bringing lead mining technique into the area. He used Métis or Creole peoples. These are people who usually have Native American mothers and French fathers. These folks were hired by Julien Dubuc to mine the lead both in Dubuque area and Galena, Illinois, which is right across the river. So you see you have this sort of, you can't just talk about one state really because it's a regional lead mining district that covers all these areas. So he died in 1810, and the government, the American government, now was very interested in this lead mine district that he had really
cultivated.
Created.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So they decided that they were going to try to do a treaty with the Native Americans, and there was a very contested 1804 treaty. And that treaty, the Native Americans said that is not okay because the folks who signed it on the Native American side were not actually legitimately allowed to sign treaties with the government. So they did not abide by it, but the American government insisted that they owned the whole lead mining district. So it was a very contested region for quite a long time.
What was the day-to-day life like for those early miners in this district?
Well, when we get to about 1821, we start seeing Southerners coming up from southern Illinois, Kentucky, Missouri. They already have some skills. There was a big lead mine district in Missouri that was playing out quite well. Their problem was getting the lead ore, which is super heavy, to a body of water like the Mississippi River so it could actually be transported. So they wanted to find a district that maybe they could mine lead and get the ore to market more easily. Well, Galena, Illinois offered that opportunity. So early lead miners came up the Mississippi River. That was the highway at the time, if you will. And they started mining in about 1821. They brought with them, though, militia and federal troops in order to show the Native American people that they meant business and that they were not going to be scared off the land. And so it started really as a military and entrepreneurial expedition with the government trying to control the area but having a really hard time doing it.
We're exploring Wisconsin's mining history, which started hundreds of years ago when Native Americans mined lead ore. UW-Platteville Senior Lecturer Emeritus of History Tracy Roberts is with us. And according to the Mining and Rollo Jamison Museums in Platteville, you'll still find zinc and lead ore under the towns and farms in southwestern Wisconsin. Have you spent time in that part of the state? Do you live there? How is the region's mining history part of your community heritage? How does it affect life today? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about Wisconsin's mining history. According to the Wisconsin Historical Society, lead mining in the state peaked in the 1840s. Demand for lead, though, began to decline, even though Wisconsin's mines offered more than half of the nation's output. And we want to hear from you. Did your family come to Wisconsin because of mining? How is Wisconsin mining part of your family or community story? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Historian and author Tracy Roberts stays with us. Tracy, now it's time to bring in those badgers. In the piece we heard earlier, we learned about badger holes. You've done research on those and badger huts. What are those, and what's the relation to mining?
Okay, so as I walk the land in this wonderful, beautiful, unglaciated region, sometimes I stumble upon evidence of the 19th century, and I came to be aware of these little buildings that are arch stone structures, and they're out in the countryside, not near developed home sites, and I came to realize that these were housing for early miners. So the question about miners living in badger holes or badger huts, a hut being the little stone buildings I'm talking about, they did actually sleep in these places. And there is documentary evidence that they actually slept in these holes and in caves and in crevices. A lot of the miners who came here, especially from the south, Missouri, Illinois, Kentucky, they weren't staying for long. In fact, the Illinois folks were called badgers. They were called suckers because, like the sucker fish, they would come north to mine just a couple months in the summer, and then they'd go back down to their homes in the south like the sucker fish does. It just comes up for a little while. So the whole area was pockmarked with these test holes and mining holes, and they weren't very deep at first. So some people... there is documentary evidence that they literally created like a little sleeping pad for themselves near the mines that they might be working.
One of the exhibits at the Mining and Rollo Jamison Museums explores the work of African-American lead miners in the state. How did their work contribute to this history?
Well, it contributed greatly, and the unfortunate and kind of disturbing history is that because Wisconsin is part of the Northwest Territory, no enslaved individuals were allowed to be in the territory. However, many of the prominent miners brought with them from the southern states enslaved peoples. In fact, our own Henry Dodge, the first territorial governor, brought a family of enslaved peoples, Africans, Americans. So this is a kind of an uncomfortable history because many of these folks weren't manumitted for at least 10 years after they arrived in the district. The district really boomed in Wisconsin in 1827. That's sort of our boom year when it really took off. And that's when Henry Dodge showed up here as well. And he, of course, created an enclave near Dodgeville.
And you're writing a book about Henry Dodge. What was his involvement with lead mining?
Well, he had already mined lead in Missouri, and that's how I got interested in him, because I was interested in what is that chain migration from Missouri miners to our miners up here in the lead mine district of Wisconsin. And I realized that he was a prominent person. He'd been involved with the military. He'd been involved with lead mining. He was really skilled. And so when he came up and brought his large family and this family of enslaved African-Americans, he created a big enclave near Dodgeville. It was a picketed area. In other words, it was all walled off, and he was contesting the Ho-Chunk involvement. He was contesting that they should be allowed to, well, that he was contesting that he should be allowed to be there, but they were saying no, you don't have a right to be here. So it was a highly contested problem for him, and so he created sort of a military compound at his home.
Tracy, when do we see the decline of mining in this part of the state, and what contributed to that decline?
Well, a couple things. Mining declined after the 1840s. As you said, the peak was 1845 about. All kinds of people were in the district by then. We had a polyglot of people speaking all different languages with different customs and costumes, and it would have been really exciting to be here at that time. The Spanish began to have a very robust mining industry, and they started taking over internationally this big lead trade. That was one issue. The other issue, more immediate to the miners themselves, is that mining, as you go deeper and deeper to get the lead ore, the easy ore is gone now, right? The stuff that's sitting on the surface or close to the surface has been mined out. Now they have to go deeper, and they're running into the water table. And they don't have an efficient means to get the water out of the mines. And so they're having trouble mining effectively and efficiently and for a profit.
We're tracing Wisconsin's mining history with Tracy Roberts as our guide. We've heard from Jeanette in Dodgeville, who called in to say, Tracy, that on Highway 23, there is a badger hole with a carved opening that you can see. And miners, she said, also lived in barrels near Mineral Point, called it Barrel Town.
Great. I did not hear about them living in a barrel. I thought it was called Barrel Town for other reasons, but that's really interesting. I'd love to follow up on that, so I appreciate that.
When do we see a transition to zinc mining? How does that happen?
Well, it's sort of a slow trickling of the lead mine industry. And, you know, it's still going on, but it's not the lucrative major industry it was. Farming becomes so important in southwest Wisconsin. But zinc really comes up about 1900. So right before World War I, there becomes an increased need for zinc for all kinds of reasons, both technological reasons, using zinc in new technologies, and for making tin and all kinds of different metals. So that industry really increases during World War I, where zinc is a very much needed component. It's a sharp increase. And so we see all these new mines opening and new processing facilities to actually refine the zinc ore. So it's a big business around here. Finally, the last ones close in the late 60s, 70s, 1970s, and they are completely closed by that time. And our mining industry has been history.
Let's bring in Al joining us from La Crosse. Hi, Al.
Hi. I just wanted to emphasize that the development of the Lloyd Zinc Mining District in southwest Wisconsin was premised on the forced removal of the Ho-Chunk, who at that time were called the Winnebago, who had been in the area and mining for thousands of years before the white miners invaded their lands and brought the military to suppress the revolt of the Winnebago in 1827. And eventually drove out the native presence, including the Ho-Chunk, the Sauk, and the Fox, in the Black Hawk War of 1832. So this is a very bloody history, which tends to be overlooked in the celebration of the Badger.
Al, thank you so much for the call. Tracy, a lot of conflict here over these native lands.
Mm-hmm. A lot of conflict. Finally, with the Black Hawk War and the defeat of Black Hawk, was a Sauk warrior from Illinois who had actually traveled with his large group through Wisconsin to the Madison area or Four Lakes at that time, and then being massacred in the Mississippi River, his people. He did not die in that battle. But, yes, a very sad history, and that is very much part of what I want to present when I talk about lead mining, that this was a contested land. This is not just happy miners walking into a empty wilderness. That's not how it happened at all.
And very quickly, Tracy, how can people learn more about Wisconsin's lead mining history?
Well, I hope they'll go to the Mining and Rollo Jamison Museums in Platteville, because we have lots of exhibits, plus we have a mine, and you can go in that mine and learn all about what it's like to be underground in a lead mine. So we'd love to show you that. The mine is from 1845 when Lorenzo Bevins opened that mine up here in Platteville.
Tracy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Tracy Roberts is a senior lecturer emeritus of the UW-Platteville History Department, affiliated with the Mining and Rollo Jamison Museums in Platteville. And what is happening in your part of the state that could reach all corners of Wisconsin? Send your ideas for Wisconsin Weekend to mornings@wpr.org. That's mornings@wpr.org, and we'll explore your tip for a future Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.